The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Chris Canangla from the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from The Junior Historian. This is published by the North Carolina Museum of History. It is the fall 2025 issue, and it is a magazine, so you're going to hear some crackling of me turning pages, etc. Let me just sort of describe the cover for you. It's really lovely. A pair of hands, elderly hands, it looks like, and they're doing something with clay. What is it? Well, the hands shaping clay on this issue's cover are those of Sonora Richardson Lynch. She's a potter and member of the Halawa Saponi tribe. The photo is from her pottery workshop at the American Indian Heritage Celebration Education Day back in 2014. She was making a turtle, one of her favorite subjects. All right, let's get into the magazine. And thought I'd start with a little message that's inside the front cover. This is from Colleen McGilvery. She is the Tar Heel Junior Historian Association Program Coordinator, and she's a student. And she says, "Hi, everybody. I like to watch movies and plays. I love to read books. I tap my toes and dance when I listen to music. At home, I hang colorful art prints on the walls. And I'm glad I live in a place that inspires people to make art, like movies, books, music, and more. North Carolina has a long history of making art. People that make art are called artists or creatives, and the state has supported many of them. In 1963, the General Assembly established the University of North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem. It was the first public arts conservatory in the United States. A conservatory is a school for the study of arts like music, dance, and drawing. High school and college students can apply to study at UNCSA. You may know of a few people who went there. Some of her favorites include Hunter Schafer and Danny McBride. But artists and other creative people don't have to go to a special school. They can create whenever, and people in North Carolina create. North Carolina is a creative place. I hope you are inspired by the stories in this magazine. Who knows what you might make?" All right, let's start with a question. And here's the question. What is creativity? What do you think it is? Well, creativity is intelligence having fun. It's when you use your imagination to come up with new ideas, solve problems, or make new and original things. Creativity is about asking questions, being curious, and trying new things, even if you might make mistakes. That's part of making art. Creativity can show up in art, music, writing, crafts, inventions, design, even in how you think about and solve everyday problems. Creativity is a way to explore life and express your feelings. Everyone is creative in their own way. The first article here on page 3 is entitled Carolina Creates, Imagination and Innovation in North Carolina. It is written by Georgianne Eubanks. Quick note, Georgianne Eubanks is a writer, teacher, and documentarian, and the author of 6 books published by the University of North Carolina Press, including the Literary Trails Guidebook Series commissioned by the NC Arts Council. And so here she writes, "My home is filled with objects fashioned by the hands of North Carolina people. Brilliant blue and yellow blown glass, jugs and plates made of our native red clay, complicated quilts, sturdy furniture, oak slat baskets, intricate woven rugs, dazzling paintings, and arresting photographs taken in all seasons." Did you use your imagination when I was running through that list? The scenes run from east to west. The Body Island Lighthouse, a lone tobacco barn in the Piedmont, Mount Mitchell in a frozen fog, the South Tow River curving through ancient boulders studded with mica. And then there are all the books in my library, novels, memoirs, poetry collections. They tell the tales of Tar Heels through centuries of history, offered in bright sentences, stories blazing with rhythm and urgency. We live in a state of inspiration. Many of us, whatever our talents, have been drawn to write, paint, sculpt, and make objects both useful and whimsical. We can't help it. It seems we are creative creatures. When an English expedition of settlers arrived on the Outer Banks in 1585, an accomplished artist, John White, was among them. White was the first Englishman to document the beauty of the land and the cultural habits of the first people who lived in Secotan, an Indian village on the north shore of the Pamlico River. For more than four centuries now, people have been capturing the essence of North Carolina's beauty and diversity, of peoples, of landscape, of native plants and rushing waters, in many media. By the early 20th century, a rush of interest in preserving and celebrating North Carolina's long traditions of art making and creativity took off. Three thriving schools of craft, two dating back to the 1920s, are still teaching such practices as weaving, book and jewelry making, ceramics, musical instrument building, wood carving, and old-time music and dance. The John C. Campbell Folk School, established in 1925 in Brasstown, Cherokee County, the Pendland School of Craft, founded in 1929 near Spruce Pine in Mitchell County, and the Pocosin Arts School of Fine Art, founded in 1994 in Columbia, Tyrell County, offer classes that are open to all curious, emerging, seasoned makers. Beyond the founders of these local schools of art, our civic leaders in North Carolina figured out early on how important the arts are to our citizens. Our leaders responded with their own creativity. The first state-sponsored symphony orchestra in the nation was begun here in 1932. Let me read that sentence again. Let that sink in. The first state-sponsored symphony orchestra in the nation was begun here in 1932. Then, in 1947, the North Carolina legislature allocated $1 million to the North Carolina State Art Society to grow the state's art collection. And by 1956, the state had established the first publicly funded art museum in the country. In 1964, Governor Terry Sanford established the North Carolina Arts Council with a mission of arts for all people. America's first state-supported public conservatory, now called the University of North Carolina School of the Arts, was established in 1963. Five schools, dance, design, and production, drama, filmmaking, and music, still offer early training to talented high school and college students on the campus in Winston-Salem, a city which was already home to the first locally established arts council in the United States. It is now known as the City of Arts and Innovation. To be an artist in North Carolina is to feel the promise and possibility of creativity as a way of life. We are truly a state of inspiration, and we stand on the shoulders of all the artists who came before, generous guides and teachers who have gifted us with their finest works and a path to create our own. Think about it. And think about this. Where can you find art and creativity? Here's another question for you. Well, in your pocket, on a dime, in a book, on a stamp, on a bed, on a wall, in a building, in a photograph, on stage, in the streets, in the clothes you wear, in the furniture you sit on, in the things you use, in the music you hear, in the history you read. When life brings trouble, make art, is this next little article about the Watoga High School Playmakers. And what do you do when you feel sad or scared, when bad things happen, when disaster strikes? Some theater students in Western North Carolina turn their experience and their feelings into dramatic art. The Last Wave was a play written and performed by the Watoga High School Playmakers in the fall of 2024. The play was a creative response to the students' experiences in Boone after the devastating 2024 Hurricane Helene. They received high honors at the NC State Theater Competition and claimed 3 awards at the 2025 National Southeast Theater Conference: Outstanding Ensemble, Best Original Play, and Best Song Composition. Quote, "We all felt the impact of Helene," says Bailey Reese, Batuga High School rising senior. "It was the one thing we experienced together. Surge," is the name of the play, "was our story. It was devastation and resilience. We built Surge out of the wreckage of Hurricane Helene and donated money we raised for hurricane relief organizations to give back to our community. It's more than just a play written by high schoolers. It is a visual tale of our survival." Now, this next article is entitled Adaptable Textiles, and it is written by Diana Bell Kite. Diana is curator of textiles and clothing at the NC Museum of History. Let me see if I can kind of describe some of these things on these pages here. There is a photograph of a lovely quilt. A quilt is a kind of a throw or a blanket made of many, many pieces of fabric that are not all the same. And they're usually cut into little triangles and sewn together in various patterns to make a lovely array of color and shapes that are just wonderful, not just to look at, but mighty comfy to sleep in. There's also a photograph of a dress made out of, I don't even know how to describe this, but I'm going to try. It is a dress with, it's very long. It's all from neck to below the ankles, and it is involving all sorts of interesting design and fabric and many colors, and it has flowers. It has sleeves that are, gosh, I wish my wife was here to tell you, but she's not, so I'm going to try. Imagine if the sleeves were pulled up and kind of gathered together, and then there's a little collar around the neck. I'm not very good at this, so I'm just going to keep on going. I'm going to read the article instead. All right. "For creative North Carolinian women of the past, expressing themselves did not necessarily require expensive materials. Textiles, fabrics, and threads made of fibers were especially suitable for reuse and repurposing. The objects described here in this article are all part of the museum's artifact collection. They all tell stories of North Carolina women who used textiles in creative and thrifty ways to make items, but they also show that these women chose to make them beautiful. For much of North Carolina's history, tobacco has been an important cash crop. But this was especially true in the eastern part of the state. People who lived and worked on small farms in the 1900s often used cheap cotton string called tobacco twine to tie tobacco leaves to sticks. Then they hung these sticks in a curing barn. Next, a steady fire would slowly cure the leaves, changing them from green to yellow. Afterward, the leaves would be sold to companies that turned them into cigarettes and smoking tobacco, products we now know to be unhealthy. Some farm women thought of a new use for the tobacco string. They used it to make textiles to decorate their homes. In the early 1980s, Frances Rouse Shackelford of Kinston, Lenoir County, made a crocheted bedspread that I was attempting to describe to you in a little earlier. She created an 8-pointed tufted star pattern using tobacco twine. Another way rural women reused materials for decorative purposes was by sewing with feed sacks. Animal feed, as well as flour and sugar, used to be sold in cotton bags rather than plastic or paper. Many women saved these bags and unraveled their seams. Then they could reuse the fabric to make clothes, curtains, tablecloths, and quilts. Lydia Cox of Mitchell County made the Thousand Pyramids pattern quilt that I attempted to describe to you. In the fabric she used on the back, the brand name is still visible from a repurposed flour sack. Women did not reuse and repurpose materials for bed covers. Some also, not just for that, remade their old dresses to fit new styles. A member of the Stacy family of Ruffin in Rockingham County reworked a dress at night shown here that I also attempted to describe during the 1890s. The construction details indicate that it may have been an older dress quickly remade with larger sleeves to fit the in look of the 1890s. The patterns appear bold and clashing to many of us today, but the person who made or altered it was likely pleased with her creation. She and her family kept and carefully preserved it for a century before donating it to the museum. Another way to make something beautiful with few resources was to use tiny leftover bits of fabric. Bertha Bridges was a laundress and single mother from Shelby, Cleveland County. She used small cloth pieces in a Lemoyne Star pattern quilt. She saved her scraps of fabric over time. She then used newspaper to create pattern pieces to help her sew the small fragments together into larger pieces. This method is called string piecing. Bridges made a quilt top that was both thrifty and decorative by using this technique. Well, she never finished the quilt, but most sewists remove the newspaper before adding the backing, batting, which is the fill, and binding. Another woman reused scrap textiles to make something useful and beautiful was by making rag rugs. Cloth scraps could be braided or woven into decorative and useful floor coverings. Sally Farabee Parnell of Tyro, Davidson County, made woven rag rugs for a century. Her mother taught her to weave at age 7, and she continued until she died at age 107 in 1995. She used a loom her family had owned since the late 1700s. She gained widespread fame for the quality and beauty of her rugs during her lifetime. So, what about fashion today? Well, clothes aren't just something we wear every day. They do have a purpose. People first used clothes to stay warm, protect their skin from the sun or cold, and keep safe. But today, clothes are more than that. They're a way to tell the world who we are. They're like a canvas for our personality. In 1899, the North Carolina College of Agriculture and Mechanic Arts in Raleigh first offered classes in textiles. That's when the dress on page 7, which is the one that I described as having the multiple colors and the sleeves that are shorter and various flowers and all that kind of stuff, when that was still in style. Today we know that school as North Carolina State University. The school's Wilson College of Textiles teaches students how to design and create fabrics, clothing, and even new materials. It is the only college in the United States that focuses just on textiles. Compare that 1890s dress to the 1929 fashion shown above, which is, let your imagination run wild. Imagine clothes that don't look like anything you've seen before or have felt or are in your own closet. They might be made out of paper. They might look like an explosion. they might have radical colors and things hanging off them. You never know. Well, one thing you might know something about is music, because you listen to a lot of music. And one of the most important styles of music in North Carolina, of course, involves banjo music. In the early 2025, the NC Music Office was asked at the museum to make an oversized banjo interactive for the first Biscuits and Banjos Festival in Durham. This is an article written by Nathan Grimes. Nathan is an exhibit design fabricator at the North Carolina Museum of History. Anyway, an interactive is a hands-on exhibit piece designed to be touched by viewers to help them explore and learn more. So this is something that might be of interest to anyone who is blind or sight impaired at the museum. The festival from Grammy winner Rhiannon Giddens celebrated African-American folk music in North Carolina. Giddens plays banjo as well. She, incidentally, is an award-winning American musician. She's from Greensboro. She started the Biscuits and Banjos Festival in Durham in 2025. Nathan says, we had two goals for our project. This is the guy who designed the exhibit. We had two goals for our project: to emphasize the historical Afro-Caribbean roots of the banjo. Did you know that that's the root of the banjo is Afro-Caribbean? And to provide a community chalkboard surface surface for festival attendees. As musicians, my teammate Trent Bowles and I wanted this to be a functional 9-foot-long musical instrument. The modern banjo is descended from instruments played in the 17th century North America and the Caribbean by enslaved people taken from the West and Central Africa. Before the Civil War, many enslaved people played the banjo. From there, the banjo spread throughout the South. Today, you'll hear it used in bluegrass, blues, and folk. Well-known banjo players from North Carolina include Elizabeth Libba Cotton. She lived 1893 to 1987. She's from Carrboro. And, of course, Earl Scruggs, 1924 to 2012, from Cleveland County. So, to build this big banjo, let me see if I can describe it to you. Imagine, for a moment, a large pot, round pot, and it has a neck, a circular opening. Part of the pot is cut away, and it's covered with looks like a cloth or some sort of canvas. And coming out of that neck, it's a short neck, is what was probably at one time a 2x4. And it is shaped like a banjo neck. And it is resting on a bar stool. So it's, creative, which is the theme of this program. And it's got 1, 2, 3, 4 strings, it looks like. And there's a gentleman who's basically sitting on the floor and plucking the strings. And this is this giant banjo that they've got at the museum. So to build the big banjo, we use materials on hand in our exhibit shop: lumber, plywood, foam, fabric, and paint. The gourd part needed to be hollow and lightweight, yet strong enough to withstand string tension and public interaction. Our engineering solution was to construct a soccer ball from the thin mitered plywood panels. This was covered with foam, rounded over, hardened with glue-soaked canvas, and then painted. Well, that's pretty creative. The instrument neck is built like an actual banjo, spike, but put on a much larger scale. It is made from recycled heartwood pine flooring and carved down to shape. The tuning pegs, bridge, and tailpiece are all hand-carved maple. The 4 strings are different gauges of weed eater line and other nylon monofilament. The banjo head is a stretched goatskin. The big banjo was then affixed to a 4-foot by 10-foot self-supporting backboard adorned with a geographic cutout of North Carolina. And after the festival, the banjo became part of the North Carolina Museum of History's traveling exhibits. Boy, I do hope you get a chance to see this thing, or at least to feel it, touch it, and make some music of your own. Let's see, we have about 6 minutes left here. A little time for one more little article here. This is called Jugtown Pottery, A Living Tradition, by Ray Owen. And who is Ray? He's a writer from Southern Pines. History runs deep in the Red Clay Hills on the northwest edge of Moore County at the Randolph County line. It was here that Raleigh artists Jacques and Juliana Busby founded Jugtown Pottery after finding a redware pie plate at the Lexington County Fair on May 1, 1917. They traced the dish back to the Seagrove community, where they found potters still turning the old-time wares. The Busbys began marketing the local potter's handiwork and brought new life to the dwindling trade by introducing the craftsmen to the world's great ceramic traditions. Jacques and Juliana were initially viewed with great suspicion in Seagrove with their foreign Raleigh accents. They began buying pottery and reselling it in a New York City shop called the Village Store and Tea Room. The first pots made from this store were utilitarian shapes crafted by older potters. Around 1922, the Busbys built their own potter shop at its present location in northwest Moore County. They began stamping each piece with a circular Jugtown ware stamp, and they hired and trained potters to have greater control over production. The first potter employed was J. H. Owen, followed by Charlie Teague and Ben Owen. Neither one of the Busbys made pottery themselves, but Juliana decorated pieces with brushwork, and Jacques developed the forms by working closely with the potters. He most admired the early periods of Chinese and Korean pottery, and he introduced translations of ceramics at Jugtown, a hybrid between the older Carolina forms and world clay traditions. Under his influence, the potters produced decorative pieces in a wide variety of glazes, resulting in pots that appeal to a broader audience. This would have a lasting impact on pottery making in North Carolina. After Jacques Busby's death in 1947, Juliana continued to operate Jugtown Pottery with the assistance of Ben Owen. In 1959, a businessman named John Murray assumed management of the pottery, and Ben Owen left to establish his own shop. A year later, potter Vernon Owens was hired. He's a cousin of Ben's and the grandson of J.H. Owen. Over the generations, for various reasons, different sides of the family began spelling the last name with or without the S on the end. Both Murray and Juliana Busby died in 1962, and the pottery was sold in 1968 to Country Roads, a nonprofit organization. In 1983, Jugtown was purchased by Vernon and his wife Pamela, and they continue to operate the shop along with their son Travis and daughter Bailey. The story of Jugtown is much larger than just the pottery itself. The thread of connection between individuals throughout the generations is critical for its survival. Such a lineage is a fragile thing, often passed between parent and child, and lost forever if the chain is ever broken. Sustaining the tradition is tied to a sense of being part of something greater than yourself. There's also a feeling that those before you kept it alive under much harder circumstances, so the burden is even greater to sustain the craft in better times. Bailey learned to make pots as a toddler by watching her parents. Among her earliest memories is crafting masks of animal faces. Sometimes when her friends came over to play, they would make a few pots to take home with them. When she was small, Bailey wore a tiny apron to keep her clothes clean, and she particularly disliked getting clay in her hair. Quote, "I had a fairy garden with a house that Dad helped me build," she recalled. "I would make little furniture to play with. I still love making animal figures and trying to capture their wild essence. Sometimes I wonder how different it was growing up in a pottery 100 years ago, and if they played the same little games with clay that we played." Like his sister, Travis learned by watching his parents work. His earliest memory is being inside the kiln, passing pots to whoever was loading it. "That's your job when you're real small. It was work, but when you're little, it was fun. My dad built me a small kiln, a very scaled-down version of the big ones. I fired it with wood and made pots that fit inside. As an adult, it's gratifying to make things people use on a daily basis and being a part of Jugtown. My advice for any young person working with clay is don't be discouraged, because it isn't easy. We're all constantly learning throughout our life. As potters, just stick with it. You practice and you have fun." Through the years, the Jugtown Pottery Complex has remained basically unchanged and is considered one of the most significant traditional potteries in America. The site is on the National Register of Historic Places. Come visit us in Seagrove. Again, Ray Owen is a writer from Southern Pines, and he's been a contributor to various magazines and books, and wrote the words for the Bleeding Pines Oratorio, created with composer David Ludwig. Well, that's about all the time we've got for today. We've run out of time, so be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Chris Conangla, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And the content of this program is intended. Let me see if I can start the music. Hello, music. Where are you? Let's start the music. And go, music. There you go. This content of program intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.com.